When thoughts arise, and then do all things arise. When thoughts vanish, then do all things vanish. Hong Bo Ji Yun. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week, and I really appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy this episode and go back and listen to our backlog, and if you're a returning listener, thank you as always. Your support means a lot. This week, we're going to be covering areas today that would be considered the south of modern China, as well as, you know, some areas in northern Vietnam, and maybe a little overlap with some places we covered last week. And these would be the peoples living there between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever of those options you prefer. Like the last couple of episodes, I just wanted to remind you that this is based on, obviously, current archaeological evidence, genetic studies, and linguistic theories. In the future, obviously, our knowledge on any and all these subjects may change. In fact, there is some new data that I'm kind of happy to share about, something I discussed in this region last season. But before that, last week, I talked about the relation between the Halbanian peoples and the Adamanese peoples, how they diverged off from the same population. One that was probably somewhere in the northeast of the Indian subcontinent / Southeast Asia, southern, kind of southern Indian region, possibly. I also very roughly talked about their relation to groups to their north. And I'm going to try and clear that up a bit. I know that's kind of a... I was mainly focused on my research last week about Southeast Asia. And this week I kind of want to clear up, since we're going to be talking about many of those groups in East Asia. And this is going to be kind of me trying to clear some of that up and introduce some ideas that we'll be going over the next couple of episodes. In the distant past, a sibling group to the common ancestral group of the Halbanian and the Andamanese developed, and numerous distinct genetic groups would develop from this population, and many would grow and expand to other regions. It is their descendants who would form the various branches for several populations that would, of course, expand and intermix with each other, not to mention that some that would probably interbreed with Denisovans, maybe Neanderthals, and also with the Halbanian and Andamanese eventually, though that may not have happened until at some point this season or next. Now, these interactions happen several times and at several locations. And not all descendants of the sibling group to the ancestors of the Halbanian and Andamanese remained in East Asia. Some groups would move even further to the north, with their descendants eventually becoming what's known as the Paleo-Siberians and the ancestors to what will eventually become Native Americans, respectively. Now, we've already discussed these migrations in earlier episodes. Our next few episodes in East Asia will again be focusing on the various groups that remained in Asia and whose continued growth and expansion will contribute to human development history into the historical period and modern day. Now, there is also one other group whose descendants we will be talking about in this kind of section as well. And this is what is known as the Ancient Tibetans. This group descended from a sibling group to the last common ancestors of East Asians and Southeast Asians. But that we'll talk more about the Ancient Tibetans later when we deal with events further north this season. But again, all for the future. I just wanted to kind of introduce that concept that there are other groups aside from the East Asian descent groups. For now, though, I'm going to talk about the Longlin or Guangxi people. I mentioned them in detail, I think, last season and in season two. But this lineage is associated with several sites. But the most famous of those is the Red Deer Cave or Maludong, and Lao Mao Cao, I'm not sure how that's pronounced in the local dialect, in Longlin, in what is today the modern country of China. For a time, the remains at the Red Deer Cave were thought to have been either an archaic hominid or a mix of Homo sapiens and other hominids like Denisovans. And this was because of their bones, their skulls had very prominent brow ridges, very flat, wide cheeks and jaws, etc. However, several remains at these various sites did end up having testable DNA, and all these tests show that these were modern Homo sapiens, and that they did develop out of the first group of the ancient East Asians. In fact, their lineage probably split off at around the same time as the lineage that would become the Jomon people of Japan, or what's now modern Japan, did. Which is before the split and development of the northern and southern East Asian lineages, though both the Guangxi and Jomon lineages do have different relationships to both of those groups in terms of like what DNA they share. But the fact that they have, they're missing some of the traits that those later people did means they split off from around the same time. But that's all stuff we'll kind of get into. Now, last time, or last season, or the season before, I forget which it was, I talked about these people, and I said that of the DNA that had been tested, there was no evidence that their descendants contributed to a modern gene pool. There is some new evidence that that is not the case, and this is from a 2024 study by Bennett et al. They found that there were a couple of individuals that had some shared DNA with the Longlin and Guangxi lineage. Now, the way DNA modeling works is you can test it, you can kind of see, but it's not always clear in what levels some of these mixes are. They do have to occasionally play with the models to see, okay, well, this could be as much as or as little as in terms of makeup. Just the DNA due to age, it may not be, the clearest results, but, they can kind of play around with models and see. And that's one of the things that geneticists do. They debate that kind of thing. But it's possible that these remains had as much as 17% Guangxi ancestry. Which, for those of you that don't know, that means that that's within the range that one of these, or some of these individuals had at least one of their grandparents as being Guangxi. Or, it's possible it could be something like a couple of great-grandparents or four great-great-grandparents, that kind of thing. So just keep that in mind. The exact makeup and lineage, that's not something that could be tested with this kind of DNA study. Now, these remains also had Halbanian DNA, possibly as high as 30%. So this is, again, evidence that you have individuals that are crossing what today would be kind of the regional border, although, again, borders at this point are meaningless. They don't exist because there are no polities, but it does show that there is overlap and movement between these various regions, at least for a few individuals. Now, the remaining DNA is very similar to other modern Southeast Asian people, mostly those associated with Austroasiatic languages, though we don't have a specific set of remains to compare them to for those people. So most likely, these peoples have shared ancestry with modern Southeast Asians who are associated with Austroasiatic-speaking languages. Though, again, this is part of what's being debated. That may not be 100% accurate. That could be, a modern knowledge. These people at that time may not have been speaking Austroasiatic. That may have been something that happened much later. We just don't know. Now, these remains were found in the modern Dushan County and in modern China, and are dated to some point during this season. They found them at several different levels, with the oldest possibly being as old as 6,300 BC, give or take 100 years, and the most recent being between being around 4,400 BC. BCE. Now, sadly, the article I was reading, at least I didn't make note of it at the time, and I don't believe it specifically mentioned, but there doesn't appear to be much evidence of agriculture, anything like that. This appears to be a site, a couple of sites, kind of spread throughout the Dushan region, which is, it's fairly mountainous. It's a kind of a tropical mountain environment. It appears that they were mostly hunter-gatherers, and there's going to be a continuing tradition of less settled agricultural societies, which, if you look at the environment, it makes sense. There are some rivers, there are some small stretches of flatland between some of the mountains and hills, but it's not the best place for large-scale agriculture. You know, it can have, and it does have, quite a large population despite that. Today, and Dushan is just north of Longlin. They're in the two provinces that those sites are in border each other. Those are Guizhou and Guangxi, respectively. Guangxi is where Longlin is, and Dushan is in Guizhou. And today, like, again, they have very large populations. Guizhou has about 35 million people, I think, give or take. The last census I saw data from was 2010. They may have well more than that now. Guangxi, I think, as of 2010, had that one has a little bit more recent data. That one I was able to get some numbers from 2020. And at that point, it had 50 million people. There's a lot of ethnic groups there, not just the Han, which is the primary Chinese ethnic group, but there's also the Zhuang, and I know that's kind of a sort of a pejorative. They refer to themselves as, I believe it's, forgive me if I butcher this to any Zhuangzhou speakers, but Boshong. They have quite a decent population. They have around 18 million people spread throughout southern China. And then there's also the Miao or Hmong people. They have, there's around 10 million of them in China. There are also some of those peoples in Vietnam, as well as Laos. Not to mention, you know, other countries that, you know, they may have fled to during the Vietnam War. Then you have the Yi people. There's around 9 million of them in China, and about 5,000 or 6,000 in Vietnam, I believe. And then you also have the Gilao people, and they're a little bit smaller. They have around 500,000, but they are entirely in Guizhou. Though, again, I haven't done too much research onto some of those peoples just yet, just because they don't enter into the historical records until later. But the Gilao people, they do speak Gilao language, which is part of the Kra Dai. So it's very possible that they do share some ancestries with some of the people we'll be talking about in the next couple of episodes. That's true also for pretty much everyone we've been talking about, though I don't think they are all necessarily Kra Dai speakers. I haven't looked too much into the language families just yet for the modern groups. Despite the fact that, you know, the Han Chinese do make up a majority of people living in those provinces, there are parts of those provinces that are kind of autonomous zones. where the Han population is not that large. They tend to kind of congregate in the larger, more modern cities. There are several districts where there's just the various minority ethnic groups make up, you know, various parts of the population. I think in Longlin specifically, the Zhuang or Zhuang people, they make up about 50% of the population, and then you have the Yi, the Mao, the the Gilao, and they make up larger parts of the population. Though again, there are some Han in those areas. I think Longlan, the Han make up about 20%. But that's again just a few of those different kind of isolated mountain provinces. Now, in terms of the people living there at this time, again, they're hunters. They're mostly hunting deer, as you might have guessed from the Red Deer Cave. That seems to be like their primary source of protein, though they're obviously hunting other animals, birds in the mountains, things like that. Now, the next group I want to talk about, and this is more of a linguistic group than a genetic group, is kind of the Proto-Austroasiatic peoples, or people who will eventually become the speakers of the Proto-Austroasiatic languages. This also has some overlap with Southeast Asia, and I kind of mentioned that before. These people will be associated with, again, in part responsible for the spread of agriculture to Southeast Asia. Though, again, at this earlier period, it's kind of hard to narrow it down exactly where they're coming from. It is possible they're coming from somewhere along the Mekong River, possibly along the border between what is now the Yunnan province, Myanmar, Laos, somewhere in that region. Though, again, they could be further south in what is now Vietnam. And there are a couple of Austroasiatic languages in China. Though, if you look at the kind of the, the linguistic map, and if you follow the theory that, you know, where there's the most diversity in a language is kind of somewhere it arose. It's probably somewhere kind of along the Lao, Vietnam, Myanmar region, somewhere where those kind of all meet. Though, again, that is very heavily debated, and there's a lot of back and forth on what arises where. But it is very possible that rice is coming down the Mekong during this season, that is where eventually peoples along the Mekong are going to start adopting agriculture, and they're going to use their newfound surplus of food to eventually expand out from there. That stuff we'll kind of go into later. But they're, the languages that are Austroasiatic in China are fairly small in terms of speakers. There's only around 5,000 or 6,000, I think, per group. And there are, I believe, 3 Austroasiatic languages spoken in what is now China: Bulyu, Bugan, and Hmong. Though there is some debate, again, on if there's actually, you know, if these are all part of the same branch of Austroasiatic, which is known as Pakonic. There's, you know, some people say Hmong should be along in that branch along with Bugan and Bulyu, though there are those that say Hmong is its own branch of Austroasiatic. But again, where it's spoken in China is very mountainous. There are not very many places where agriculture is particularly conducive, like in the mountains, but that's typically where it is spoken in China, along smaller rivers and stream valleys there. Though again, these are way in the future, what we're talking about. Now, there are a number of sites kind of in the Mekong River, in the parts that are now in China, where there's kind of a closeness to I guess, the very headwaters of the Yangtze, as well as the Pearl River. But a lot of these early sites are either they're mixed farming, so there's evidence of not just rice, but also millet. And then there is evidence of, supplemental kind of agriculture. It's not full-blown agriculture just yet, but rice is introduced, has already been introduced along the Pearl River. There are several sites that are strictly rice farming. That's the most. There's no only millet farming this far south in China at this season. It's just rice and a mix of hunting, gathering, and again that kind of early transition stage between kind of proto-agriculture and hunting and gathering. One of these type of sites is also in what is now the Guangxi. I think technically it's in Guilin. It's actually not far from Dushan. In fact, it's in the Dushan mountain range, but it's Xingpian or Zhengpian. I'm not quite sure how that's pronounced, but it is not far. Well, in the grand scheme of things, it's not too far. It's more to the north west of the Guilin province, whereas the Dushan sites we were talking about earlier are a little bit more towards the south southwest. Excuse me. This is the northeast of Guilin. The other Dushan sites we were talking about are further to the southwest. But this site has a mix of pottery, which again was first developed in what is now China, a very long time ago. We talked about that in season 2, I believe. In fact, it may have even been season 1, now that I think about it. But so they've been using pottery well before you get the Neolithic tool set that you see in other places, where pottery kind of shows up alongside a lot of Neolithic tools. But they also have, needles, hairpins, in terms of artifacts like that. They have, of course, fishing spears, arrowheads, as well. And you do begin to see some more Neolithic type tools, those microblades, microlithics tools. But rice kind of comes in here towards the end of this period. And this site will last until about 5000 BC. And it's probably abandoned because they are becoming more reliant on rice during this season. Now, this is a very long-lasting site. It lasts from, I think, around 7,000 to about 5,500, 5,000 BC, somewhere in that range. So it's again, pretty long-lasting. And it's one of the sites where you'll see a great mix of different lifestyles adapted by probably by the same people over its long period of occupation. The site was also kind of known for flooding. There's a river nearby, so it's also possible that a part of the reason that it was abandoned is that the floods, for whatever reason, became more frequent and much more violent, which is something you see at several places in China in the historical period and in prehistoric places. It's possible that, agriculture was more important or becoming more important, but it's also possible that there's an environmental reason they moved somewhere that the floods weren't quite as bad or maybe easier to control or deal with is another reason that the site may have been abandoned. Another language family that should probably be in part associated with southern China at this period is the Kra Dai languages, or the Tai Kadai. Both terms are used. Also, Dayak is also another term. But this is a fairly widespread language family, similar to Austroasiatic. However, you'll see a lot more variation in the language family in what is now southern China. You have the Kra languages, which are spoken in kind of the northern part of Vietnam slash southern China. Then you also have some Kra languages further north, north of the Pearl River, or also known as the Zhejiang River. Then you also have the Central Tai languages and the Northern Tai and the Kam Sui languages are also in China. You also have the Bay and the Lai languages, which are in the island to the south of China, Hainan. And so you see more branches of Kra Dai in what is now southern China than you do in Southeast Asia, though the largest branch is in Southeast Asia, which again kind of makes it a little bit of a kind of a confusing subject to talk about. But those are known as the Southwestern Thai languages, and those are spoken in what is now Thailand. These people would be probably the ancestors of what later Chinese historians will call the Bai Yue, or the 100 Yue, or just the Yue. It was kind of like a umbrella term that they used to describe like a bunch of different ethnic groups living in what is now southern China. But at the time when they're first written down, they're kind of on the outskirts of Chinese, Han Chinese civilization. And, you know, we'll talk more about that in depth when we get to that period. But the region itself is not part of China proper until much later. Most likely the Kra Dai make up the bulk of the Yue people. At least that's the current theory. Though again, not all Yue people would necessarily be Kra Dai speakers. It's just kind of how the Chinese associated them to themselves. And at some points, you know, they had closer political ties to what would now be Vietnam. But again, that's all stuff we'll talk about in the next few seasons to talk about the region. But yeah, so that's kind of a very rough overview of genetics and linguistics and some of the bigger sites kind of in the more mountainous regions of southern China. Next week, we're going to be moving a little bit to the east and north. We'll be talking about the Zhejiang River, the Yangtze River civilizations, you'll see more solid, more societies or groups more aligned with agriculture rather than hunting and gathering. Though again, there's still a mix in a lot of these places. Not all groups are going to 100% adopt agriculture immediately, which is something we'll be discussing again over the next couple of episodes. But I'd like to thank everyone for joining me. I hope this was a little bit clearer, at least in terms of the genetic stuff. And we will be, going into more detail on that kind of stuff next week when we talk about the Northern East Asians. And the Southern East Asians, again, you have a number of different groups with a lot of overlap between groups in Southeast Asia, at least in the modern day. And in fact, Southern China, genetically speaking, is much more diverse than Northern China. That's not to say Northern China isn't diverse, but it's just not as diverse as Southern China. But again, that's all stuff we'll cover. If you guys have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, sources you want to share with me, please do. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me via direct message on X/Twitter. You can comment on the YouTube videos, wherever you listen. You can send me an email to waradrevpod@gmail.com. However you'd like to reach out to me, please feel free to do so. But yeah, I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode, and I hope you will be back next week. And I will see everyone next time, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from wherever you're listening. Please like, subscribe, rate 5 stars, download, however the service you're using tracks and, you know, promotes episodes, please feel free to do so. It'll help the channel grow more. We're almost to 240 subscribers on YouTube. We're getting there. And again, my audio only listeners, thank you guys for all the support. Seen a lot of growth the last month or so, and I really appreciate it. So we'll see everyone next time. You all have a good one. Peace.